that, Hark told him, the same lesson that Bill had taught him long ago. The world began to spin. Oh, fuck, he mumbled before he blacked out. How is he? Alma asked Dr. Levinson outside Hart's room at the infirmary while he was supposed to be resting.
Lucky. Most people would have wound up with sepsis with a wound like that, but he's healing almost as fast as Rosie Fox.
Hart felt as if every organ in his body had dropped to the floor beneath the uncomfortable hospital bed, because Marshal Rosie Fox was an immortal demigod, definitely conclusively immortal.
Ah, said Alma,
and Hart knew her well enough to hear the unease in that one syllable.
Can I see him? I suppose, but don't wake him. He needs rest.
Dr. Levinson led Alma into the room as she jotted down notes on Hart's chart.
Well, look who's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed this morning, Alma said when she saw that he was awake. Some bed rest, and you'll be right as rain in a few days, Marshal,
the doctor added. Great, said Hart. And realizing that his flat tone made him sound like an ingrate, he added, Thanks.
Can I have a minute with him? Alma asked the doctor. Sure.
She waited until the doctor was out of the room before asking,
Ralston, why do you have to be Tanria's punching bag all the time?
You say that like I get shot every 5 minutes. His tongue felt thick and dry in his mouth, probably from the painkillers.
I know you heard the Rosie Fox comment. It doesn't mean anything.
It's okay, I'm fine. Alma regarded him and tapped her fingers on the bed rail. He wasn't convincing either of them.
Want me to leave you so you can get some rest?
No, hold up. I've got something I've been meaning to say to you.
All right, but if Doc Levinson gets mad at me, it's on you.
She pulled up a stool with a screech across the linoleum floor and helped him adjust his bed to a sitting position.
Shoot.
Hart stared at his hands in his lap, red and chapped against the pale blue of his hospital gown. They didn't look like the hands of an immortal. I hate that we've drifted apart these past few years. I'm sorry I let that happen.
I'm sorry too.
She touched his arm, a gesture made more potent because it was Alma doing it. Her affection was rare and more powerful for the rarity.
But I can't apologize for what I said about Bill. I'm not going to lie about the man to make you feel better.
You have the right to your opinion, but there are things about Bill you don't know.
Why don't you tell me?
I should. I will, but not now.
Fair enough.
Hart extended his hand. Friends?
Fuck you with your handshake.
She pushed his hand aside and hugged him. It didn't help his wound, but it did wonders for his heart. Get off me, you sap. She relinquished him and sat back on the stool.
Jerk?
True. What were the perps who shot me trying to smuggle out of Tanria? Do we know?
The only thing we found on site was sailcloth, which is weird, but that's not your concern. I know this is going to make you cry, but the law requires that you take sick leave after being shot, at least a couple of days.
Hart's knee-jerk reaction was to protest. But then he realized that sick leave meant time with Mercy and the chance to come clean about the letters. Okay, he agreed.
Okay, just like that?
Yep. She squinted at him.
What's gotten into you?
He glanced around the room, at the floor, the window, the medical supply closet, anywhere but at Alma's face. I'm seeing someone.
No, really?
Really. She scooted the stool closer, the linoleum beneath it crying abuse.
Is it serious?
Maybe. She walloped him with a good-natured punch to the shoulder.
Ow! That didn't hurt, you big baby.
May I remind you that I was shot?
Come on, the suspense is killing me. Who is it?
He squirmed, but he couldn't wipe away the mawkish, pathetic grin taking over his face. Mercy Birdsall. Alma's aquamarine eyes went wide before she cackled. Shut up, he told her without an ounce of conviction.
Oh, shoes on the other foot, isn't it? Working 2-week tours sucks when you're head over heels, and now you see the light. I give it a month before you're begging me for a desk job.
So I can take some time off?
You have to wait until the doc discharges you, but yeah. Because, as you pointed out, you were shot.
She mussed his hair like she used to do when they first became partners.
Say hi to Mercy for me.
Will do. As long as Mercy didn't send him packing when he finally told her the truth, he thought. And his stupid grin vanished. Chapter 30. If Art was going down in flames, he intended to look his best for Mercy when he did so. He got a haircut and a shave, as well as 2 new shirts and a new pair of dungarees from the only men's clothier on the border that sold tall sizes, and he had his best boots shined to gleaming. He considered the purchase of a new hat as well, but given his proclivity for crushing it when he was nervous, and given the fact that he was already terrified to confess the truth to Mercy, he decided to save his money and abuse the hat he had left at Birdsall and Son. In addition to these improvements, Hart was 1 key lighter. He had returned his ID tag and funeral package to Cunningham's first thing that morning. The receptionist pulled his file, sniffed at the cheap price tag, and handed him off to a junior associate, who couldn't have been older than Duckers. The young undertaker recited a canned speech, trying to upsell Hart on one of Cunningham's many embalming packages, even as he filled out the paperwork to process Hart's return. The place was an airless, joyless, soulless approach to death, and he couldn't understand why he'd chosen to patronize Cunningham's all these years. Maybe he'd found it easier to deal with mortality as a business transaction, rather than face his own uncertain end. He stopped by the bank and his lawyer's office, so it was late afternoon, by the time he stood at the counter of Birdsall and Son, clutching a small, paper-wrapped parcel in his sweating hands, his chest tight with nerves. He heard hammering coming from the boatworks, and he hoped that Mercy wouldn't wish to use that hammer on his face as soon as he told her about the letters. He took a deep breath, which did nothing to calm his raging jitters, and rang the bell. To his consternation, it was not Mercy who answered the summons, but her father. If Zeddy and Lillian knew about Hart and Mercy, did that mean Roy knew about them too? Hart thought he might go into cardiac arrest as the man stepped behind the counter, but the affable smile on his face led Hart to believe that no one had clued him in yet.
"Good afternoon, Marshal Ralston. Dropping off a body?"
Hart wasn't sure that there was still blood flowing to his lips.
"No, I'm...
What was he supposed to say? "I'm here to see your daughter to tell her that I'm her secret pen pal? And that I'm hoping against hope that she won't hate me forever and might even want to have sex with me tonight?" A furrow of confusion and concern dove between Roy's substantial eyebrows, until Hart finally choked out the one true thing he could say to Mercy's dad.
"I'm here to buy a new funeral package."
"Well now,"
the affable smile returned. Mercy's smile, Hart realized. And the second he thought of Mercy, there she was, peering into the lobby from the hallway, her glasses sprinkled with sawdust.
"Pop, did you get the—"
She saw Hart and bit her bottom lip, and his heart leaped out of his chest to go reside in hers.
"I've got it, Muffin. Marshal Ralston is here to buy a funeral package from us."
This time, Mercy didn't bother hiding her grin.
"Is he?"
"Come on in and have a seat in the office, Marshal."
Hart turned panicked eyes on Mercy as Roy clapped him on the shoulder and ushered him through the office door.
"Tea?"
she offered, beaming at him.
"Yes, please."
"Now remind me, are we updating a current package?"
Mercy's dad asked as they took their seats on opposite sides of the desk. Hart set his parcel down on the empty chair beside him.
"No, I returned my package to Cunningham's. I'm here to buy a new one."
Roy's eyebrows shot up, taking the glasses perched on top with them.
"I see. Thank you for your business."
Hart squirmed in his chair and nodded, and Roy spread out a brochure in front of him.
"We offer a wide array of handcrafted boats in 3 price tiers. I assume you're interested in purchasing a boat?"
Hart's old package stated that he would be shrouded in a simple sailcloth, cremated, and scattered on the outskirts of the shipyard. But if building boats was what Mercy loved, he'd put down the money to buy one, an expensive one. He scanned through the options and chose the model and corresponding wood with the highest price tag. Roy's eyebrows threatened to shoot right off his face, but he perched the reading glasses on the end of his nose and scribbled down Hart's selections.
"And would you prefer that your body be interred or cremated?"
"Cremated, I guess."
"Where would you like us to send the remains?"
It was one thing to tell a perfect stranger that he had no home and therefore nowhere to send his ashes. It was another to have to admit as much to Mercy's dad.
"You can scatter them on the shipyard." "No headstone?"
Hart shook his head, and Roy's forehead creased, an expression that reminded Hart of Mercy's warm compassion.
"That's not very comforting to the loved ones you leave behind. Don't want to burden anyone with it."
Roy set down his pen.
"Where are you from, Hart?"
It was nice to hear this fatherly man call him by name. Hart crossed his ankle over his knee and wished he had his hat to set on top of his leg.
"Arvonia? I joined the Tanrian Marshals when I was 16, and I haven't been back. Got any family?"
"Not that I'm close with."
"Aren't you friends with Alma McGuire? She's your old partner, right?"
Hart thought of the last time he went to see Alma and Diane, the way they'd fretted over him in soft voices when they thought he was asleep and couldn't hear.
"Yep, we're good friends," he agreed. "I've known Alma for a long time. I don't think she'd find scattering your ashes a burden."
Maybe Roy was right. Alma did have his birth key, after all, and she was going to have to figure out what to do with that if Hart died. So he nodded his agreement. "You can add her wife's name, too, Diane Belinder." Roy picked up his pen to jot down both names in the appropriate box.
"Any instructions regarding your birth key or the keys of any family members in your care?"
"Alma McGuire is already in possession of my birth key. My mother's key should be sent to her sister, Patricia Lippitt. I assume she's still living in Pettisville, Arvonia."
"Good."
Roy jotted down the information as he continued to speak.
"I do recommend that you keep your last will and testament on file with your final arrangements. It makes it easier on your loved ones when everything is in one place."
"I have that here." Hart reached into his vest pocket and retrieved the document, folded neatly into thirds.
"Excellent."
Roy placed Hart's will into a manila file folder, along with the paperwork for his new funeral package. As he handed over the new key-shaped ID tag, he asked,
"If you don't mind my asking, what made you cancel your order with Cunningham's and purchase your arrangements from Birdsall and Son?"
Hart had not anticipated this question. He uncrossed his legs and sat up, a clammy hand on each knee. If Mercy hadn't told her father about them yet, he didn't have the right to say anything. But at the same time, he was not eager to lie. Lying, or at least sins of omission, had caused him enough problems.
"I'm dating your daughter."
His voice tapered to nothing at the end.
"I'm sorry, I didn't catch that."
Hart cleared his throat.
"I'm dating Mercy."
Roy had printed Ralston, HA on the file folder tab, but he froze, his pen clutched in his hand. A long pause sucked all the air out of the room before Mercy knocked on the door and stepped inside. She attempted to smile brightly as she set a steaming cup in front of Hart, but both men knew her well enough to see it for the nervous grimace it was.
"Everything all right?"
she sang too cheerily.
"Of course. Thank you, Muffin."
"Yep," Hart agreed, half tempted to cling to her ankle and let her drag him out of the office to safety.
"Well then."
Another brutal silence stretched through the room.
"I guess I'll leave you to it."
Mercy gave them both one last strained smile before she stepped out, closing the door behind her. Roy's eyes met Hart's over the top of his reading glasses. Hart expected to find a sharp glint of disapproval therein. Instead, Mercy's father gave him an appraising look.
I know you saved her life, but I was under the impression that you two hated each other.
It's definitely not hate.
Huh. I'm gonna need a minute to adjust to this, he said gruffly,
opening his desk drawer and pulling out the not-so-secret bottle of whiskey. He poured himself three fingers and held the neck over Hart's tea as an offer.
I'm not much of a drinker. Good to know.
Roy recapped the bottle, shoved it back in the drawer, and took a deep gulp.
No one tells me anything around here. I have three children, but you'd think I was the baby. So, you're seeing each other?
Yes.
And it sounds like it's serious, is it?
Yes, for me it is. Although, I'm not too sure I deserve her, to be honest.
Good answer.
Roy set his forearms on the desk and leaned in to study Hart, who was now experiencing heart palpitations.
Why don't you come over for dinner tonight?
Here was the nice, wholesome dinner Hart had mentioned to Mercy. But as he watched Roy's huge hand dwarf the pen, he found the invitation daunting. He wasn't accustomed to fathers, and he wasn't sure how to act around Mercy's.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Birdsall.
Roy held out his hand. Hart took it with trepidation, and his finger bones crunched alarmingly in the other man's grip.
Call me Roy.
Chapter 31. Mercy tried to work, but it was hard to concentrate when she knew that Hart was in the next room with her father, buying a funeral package, no less. Thank the salt sea she was mid-boat rather than mid-body. She was measuring a plank to cut for the third time when both men showed up in the boatworks doorway. "I believe Hart wanted to see you," said Pop. Hart. Not Marshall Ralston. What exactly had they been talking about in there? "I'm heading out for the evening, Muffin. Have a good night." "Good night, Pop." Her father chucked Hart on the arm, and though Hart was much taller, he seemed to shrink, and his face went pale. "See you tonight?" "Yes, sir. I mean, Roy." Pop's footsteps clumped down the hall and into the lobby, and the sound of the front door opening and closing followed. Hart remained in the doorframe, gripping a small brown paper parcel in his hands, his hair neatly trimmed, his face clean-shaven, and Mercy was thrilled to discover that clean-cut Hart was every bit as handsome as rugged Tanrian Marshall Hart. She raced across the boatworks and wrapped her arms around his waist. He bent to kiss her, but his lips were stiff. "You're coming over for dinner? Did I know about this?" "I unexpectedly got a few days off. Your dad just invited me." He disentangled himself from her arms and presented her with the parcel. "I got you something." "You didn't have to get me anything." "I wanted to. I guess flowers would have been better, but I thought this might be nice to have in your boatworks." Mercy took the package from him and unwrapped it, revealing a small red metal box with a foldable crank on one side and a grid of tiny holes beside a gold dial on the other. "Oh, it's wonderful. Thank you." "You have no clue what it is." "None whatsoever," she admitted. "It's a transistor." Suddenly, the red metal seemed to glow like a sunrise in her hands. "Bride of Fortune, Hart. How does it work?" "You crank it until it stops. Then you turn it on and spin the dial until you find a station you like. There are two stations on Bushong that come in loud and clear, and the Vinland stations are pretty strong, too. The volume is on the side here. It should last a good hour before you have to crank it again." She jumped up and down like a kid getting everything she wanted on her birthday. She cranked the transistor, put it beside a can of paint on the shelf, and flipped the switch to on. The red box crackled to life, blasting static into the room. She turned the dial until she hit a station playing a song that was too twangy for her liking. She kept turning until she came to the familiar blare of a trumpet and the exhilarated thumping of a bass drum. "I love this song," she cried, and then she sang along, full-throated, twirling her hips in time to the music. She didn't know the second verse, so she sang, "I love this gift. This is the best gift ever," in place of the lyrics. Hart laughed, but his gray eyes didn't light up the way they ought to. "What's wrong?"
"I'm nervous."
"About dinner?"
"Among other things."
Don't be. You have faced far scarier things in Tanria than my family. The song finished and another took its place. A slow, sweet number. I know you're Mr. Fancy Feet, but do you think you can handle the old sway in a circle?
I'll give it my best shot, he said wryly.
And Mercy decided that he was darling when he was wry. How on earth had she managed to detest him for so long? Everything he did now seeped inside her chest and took up permanent residence. She tucked her head against his shoulder as he guided her in a lazy circle to the slow, steady rhythm of the song. You're perfectly Mercy-sized, she informed him.
I'd like to think so.
He spoke the words into her hair with that quiet, sexy laugh of his. She turned her face up and nuzzled the bare skin of his neck above his collar.
Claiming the nuzzle nook outside the confines of your bed? Is that allowed?
I demand to have full and complete access to my nuzzle nook at all times.
Mercy, he said softly.
She skimmed her lips down his neck, undid the top button of his shirt, and nipped his collarbone, savoring the way his breath stuttered. She stepped back and regarded his tired, anxious face. You really are nervous, aren't you?
That is putting it mildly.
It'll be all right. I promise. She took him by the arms and gave him a reassuring shake before switching off the transistor. Do you mind if I take a quick bath before we go over?
If it's a quick bath, then yes, I mind.
Do you mind if I take a long, luxurious bath? She amended.
By all means. To clarify, I get to watch, right?
Sure, but are you up for hijinks? You look like you might be sick all over the linoleum.
I don't think I'm up for hijinks right before the nice, wholesome family dinner. Doesn't mean I'm not going to enjoy the show.
As Mercy ran the bathwater, Hart retrieved her discarded clothes and folded them neatly, setting them on the edge of the vanity. An action that struck her as mind-blowingly thoughtful after years of picking Zeddy's dirty clothes off every surface of the house. She had already fallen for this man, and yet she couldn't seem to stop falling farther and deeper. He sat on the bathroom floor, his back against the wall facing her, his long legs making giant triangles between them like an enormous cricket on the ceramic tiles. Leonard sat beside him, leaning his jowls against his beloved Marshall's chest and snorting with joy as Hart pet him.
This is even better than I thought it was going to be, he said, as he watched her sink into the hot, sudsy water.
You've imagined yourself sitting on a cold tile floor, watching me remove 5 pounds of sawdust from my person while my dog drooled on your shirt?
Many times. You have no idea. Before I forget, Alma McGuire says hi.
Mercy's heart fluttered. If Alma was passing along her regards, that meant that Hart had told his best friend about her. Her cheeks were already warm and dewy from the bathwater, but the knowledge that Hart was owning up to dating her made half the blood in her body rush to her face. Tell her I said hello back.
I will. But I hope we can hang out with Alma and Diane one of these days so you two can say hi to each other all you like in person.
He was prepared to take her along to meet up with Alma, who was practically family to him? This was getting serious. And Mercy, who had hated Hart from the depths of her soul a few months ago, was thrilled. Who's Diane?
Alma's wife. Gird yourself. She's going to hug you. A lot. If you ever meet her.
I'm sure I will.
I hope so. Mercy was glad that she was in the bathtub. Otherwise, she might be dancing a jig right about now.
Has this bath met your long and luxurious standards? Because I'm starting to wrinkle.
Can't have that.
He helped her out of the tub, and now that the soapy water no longer covered her, she felt silly and self-conscious to be standing on her bath mat, dripping and naked, when he was fully clothed. She reached for the towel, but Hart beat her to it, patting her dry himself. It was sweetly chaste. The gentle way he tousled her hair and blotted the water from her skin. As he wrapped the thick terry cloth around her shoulders, Mercy shooed Leonard out of the bathroom and reached out to undo the buttons of Hart's shirt.
Isn't your dad's house one of those classy, no shirt, no shoes, no service kind of places? He joked,
but he leaned his long frame against the wall and watched her fingers work with smoky eyes, showing no inclination to stop her. You're always the one touching me. I want to touch you for a change. She felt bold and vulnerable at once as she peeled back his shirt and slid it down his arms. She slipped her hands beneath his undershirt, pushing it up from the inside as she touched taut skin, ridged muscle, tickling hair. Mercy, I have to tell you. And a gauzy bandage wrapped around his torso. What happened? She exclaimed, bunching up the undershirt to get a better look.
It's nothing. A scratch.
That's a big bandage for a scratch. Why didn't you tell me?
In my defense, I've been very distracted since I arrived.
Hart?
He took the corners of her towel in his hands to bring her in close. I'm all right, Merciless.
You're not all right. None of this is all right. I'm scared every time you have to go back.
She reached up and stroked his sharp cheekbones with her thumbs.
Mercy, I need to. But she didn't want his words. She wanted his breath. She wanted his heartbeat. She wanted to feel the warmth of his living body, to know that he was alive and well and hers. She kissed him, and he kissed her in return with a tenderness that made her chest ache. Their movements were slow and soft as they made their way into the bedroom. He kept his forehead pressed against hers as he moved in and out of her, every movement of his body gentle and sweet. If Mercy had been unsure that she was in love with him before, she was certain of it now.
Chapter 32. Now, tell her now, thought Hart as they got dressed for dinner. But there was something he needed to straighten out before she kicked him to the curb. If she decided to kick him to the curb. Please don't kick me to the curb, he begged her in his mind. Aloud, he said, I have a proposition for you. Mercy raised an eyebrow, and although his anxiety jangled inside him, the gesture made him laugh. Not that kind of proposition.
Okay, I'm listening.
She stepped into her dress and turned, pulling her hair over her shoulder so that he could zip her up. This might be the last time he got to do something as intimate as zip her into a dress, a prospect that made telling her the truth even less alluring. What if I could help you with the business?
How do you mean?
She turned to face him, and he took her hands in his. What if I hired a lawyer to help you fight Cunningham and Afton?
As in, you'd pay for the lawyer?
He nodded. No. That was a quicker and more decisive refusal than he'd been expecting. Let me do this for you.
Absolutely not. I have the money. Good. Keep it.
She took her hands from his, and already, it felt like he was losing her. For what? I never spend it. And I love you, he wanted to say. But he didn't have the right to tell her that. Not until he came clean about the letters. I care about you and what happens to you.
I know you mean well, but this is my business. If I can't keep it afloat on my own, what's the point?
Think about it. That's all I'm asking. Her mouth turned down, but it was out of exasperation rather than anger.
Okay, I'll think about it. But if my answer is no, you have to accept that, all right?
All right. Now, right now, he told himself, when they took Leonard to play fetch at the park behind City Hall to kill time before dinner. But it was so windy outside that he would have had to shout, and he didn't want to yell his confession at her. Dear gods, now, his conscience begged him, as he and Mercy walked together to her father's house with Leonard trotting at their heels. But she wove her arm through his, and he could not bear to risk letting her go yet. And then they were on the porch, and the front door opened, and Roy ushered them inside, and he had squandered the opportunity to say what needed to be said. Now he would have to survive a family dinner at the Birdsall house before he could tell Mercy the secret that sat in his guts like a ball of lead. The first thing Hart noticed about the Birdsall house was that it was loud, and everyone seemed to be talking and laughing at once, and he couldn't figure out how so few people made so much noise. Roy kissed his daughter's cheek as they stepped inside, and he beamed at Hart as he shook his hand.
Glad you could make it.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. This was not entirely true.
but Roy clapped him on the shoulder in a welcoming and not a threatening way, and Hart felt the stiffness in his spine ease. He followed Mercy to the family altar and watched her dip her fingers into the bowl of salt water and touch her mother's key. Then she pressed her fingertips over his chest to the place where his own mother's key rested against his breastbone, and he understood then that if she broke things off with him once she knew about the letters, he would shatter, and there would be no putting him back together.
"They're here,"
Mercy's sister Lillian shouted over her shoulder, and then she was hugging him around the middle, the way she had hugged him at the Founders' Day party, the way Diane had hugged him since he was 19 years old, and he didn't dislike it, because he was fairly certain that she wouldn't be hugging him if she didn't think he was good enough for Mercy. He hugged her in return, albeit self-consciously.
"Have you met Danny yet?"
Lil asked, taking Hart by the wrist and dragging him through the dining room toward the kitchen, where Zeddy was doing acrobatic things with onions and a large frying pan over the stove, while a redheaded man leaned against the counter next to him.
"You must be Hart. I'm Lil's husband, Danny. Good to meet you."
As Hart shook his hand, Danny leaned in and murmured,
"They're terrifying, but you get used to them."
Lillian touched Hart's arm.
"Are you nervous? Don't be nervous. Have some wine. Honey, pour Hart a glass."
Danny obeyed, getting a wine glass out of the cupboard.
"I have been demoted from sous chef to waitstaff. This one won't even let me mince the garlic anymore."
Zeddy scoffed from his place at the stove.
"You call that mincing?"
"Hart's a lightweight," Mercy warned Danny. "Go easy."
Lillian took the bottle from her husband and filled Hart's glass to the brim.
"Oh, this is going to be fun. Please drink up on my behalf since I can't have any. You're so lucky you're not pregnant."
Lil gasped theatrically and set the bottle down on the counter.
"Are you?"
Hart did not require a mirror to inform him that he was blushing from head to toe.
"Not the last time I checked."
Lillian burst out laughing. She looked nothing like her sister, but their laughter was the same. Danny pulled his wife into a hug and smushed her face against his shoulder to prevent her from embarrassing Hart further.
"Forgive her, her filter is flimsy."
"But you love me anyway,"
said Lil, her voice muffled against her husband's sweater vest.
"I do."
Salt sea, thought Hart. They're adorable. They're all adorable. Spending time with Mercy's family was a lot like going over to Alma and Diane's house, though much louder. There was a comfort in this home that eased into his bones. He no longer felt like an outsider by the time they sat down to dinner, and he didn't panic in the slightest when Roy started up a conversation with him over the scalloped potatoes.
"You said you're from Arvonia, right, son? Are you an anemones fan?"
"Really, Pop?" said Mercy. "He sat down 2 seconds ago, and you're already grilling him on his sea polo preferences?"
But Hart had the bizarre urge to hug this big, burly man who called him son. And if Roy Birdsall wanted to talk about professional sea polo, Hart was game.
"I was an anemones fan when I was a kid, but I've worked in Tanria more than half my life, so I tend to root for the Bouchong giant squids these days."
Roy's eyes went misty. He patted Hart on the back.
"Good man, I like this one, Muffin."
A warmth filled him that had nothing to do with the red wine he'd hardly touched. As he sat at the Birdsall family dinner table and watched Mercy's family joke and bicker and laugh, he realized that he was falling for them, too. If, by some miracle, he managed to keep Mercy in his life, he could be a part of this. He could have a family again. A tendril of cowardly temptation eeled inside him. How terrible would it be if he never told Mercy that he was her secret friend? What good would it do to tell her about the letters now? None. He had so much to lose if he confessed, and everything to gain if he simply kept his mouth shut. Surely he could convince Duckers to see it his way. He had no sooner resolved to let his letter-writing past disappear without a trace than Zeddy, of all people, kicked off the process of destroying his life by raising a glass and declaring,
"To Hart Ralston,
The guy gets shot and almost dies and shows up to a Birdsall family dinner 2 days later.
The table did not respond with cheers. Roy, Lillian, Danny, and worst of all, Mercy, gaped at him in various states of shock or alarm. In the pit of his stomach, Hart knew that this was very bad, although his mind hadn't pieced together exactly why. Mercy turned on him.
You said it was a scratch. You were shot?
A little.
How can you be shot a little?
Mercy's voice hit operatic notes.
It's healing fine, and I didn't want to worry you.
Of course I'm worried about you. I can't believe you didn't tell me. And how did you find out about it?
The last question was directed at Zeddy, and Hart realized that this was why he was completely fucked.
I had a letter from Penn this morning.
How can you have a letter from Penn? There aren't any Nim Killam boxes in Tanria.
Yeah, but he and Hart bribed their delivery Nim Killam to pick up their mail.
Slowly, Mercy turned toward Hart, her face full of shock and anger.
I,
he said, but couldn't seem to get any further. Blood thundered in his ears.
You told me you couldn't send letters from Tanria.
That's not exactly what I said.
The second Hart spoke the words, he knew they were a mistake, as evidenced by the ice daggers shooting out of Mercy's eyes and into his chest. Zeddy sat down and leaned his head toward Lillian.
Hart's in trouble.
Did he lie to you about something?
Squealed Lil, before turning a fiery glare on Hart. Mercy slapped the table.
None of you need to be involved in this conversation.
She pointed her finger in Hart's face.
Except you. Come with me.
Hart could sense her fury and humiliation simmering like water in a tea kettle as she got up and marched through the parlor and out the front door, which she slammed shut as soon as he followed her onto the porch. He held up both hands in surrender. They were shaking badly. He was going to lose her. He could already feel his joy slipping through his fingers like sand.
Not a word out of you, she said. I'm going to need the entire walk home to calm down enough to not strangle you.
Hart nodded meekly. There was a scratching and whining at the door, and someone opened it wide enough to let Leonard out before shutting it. The dog was oblivious to the imminent destruction of Hart's life and bounded around him like a puppy. The walk to Mercy's apartment was brutal, but also far too short for him to compose a reasonable excuse as to why he'd lied about not writing to her from Tanria. Only the truth could save him now, and it probably wouldn't. He followed Mercy and Leonard through the lobby of Birdsall and Son and up the stairs, but he didn't dare go farther into her home than the door, which he leaned against for support once it had shut behind him. Mercy walked to the open kitchen, took out a glass from the cupboard, filled it with water, and drank all of it, her back to him. When she faced him again, her eyes were no longer filled with fury. They were filled with hurt, which was infinitely worse.
I don't understand why you would keep something like getting shot from me, or why you would lie to me about sending mail from Tanria. It makes me wonder what else you've kept from me.
I know.
Let's start with the part where you got shot. Why didn't you tell me?
It's probably easier to show you.
He unbuttoned his shirt and pulled up his undershirt to unwind the bandage, uncovering the pink pucker beneath. Mercy came over to study the wound, or the lack thereof. It didn't take a doctor to know that a pistol crossbow wound would not and should not have healed this quickly. Hart leaned his head against the door. He wasn't sure what he wanted to talk about less, this or the letters.
The doctor wouldn't say it outright. But I think that arrow should have been a death sentence. And yet here I am.
He spoke the words to the ceiling. It felt as if he were opening himself up to her with a crowbar. She forgave him enough to run her hand up his torso until it rested over his heart, between his keys and his skin.
Do you have any idea how glad I am that it wasn't a death sentence?
He wondered if she would be glad that he wasn't dead by the time this night was over. He took a lock of her hair and rubbed it between his fingers and thumb.
When I was 7 years old,
My grandpa took me to a circus in town. I was so excited to go, but one of the first things we did when we got there was go to the freak show. Almost everyone in that tent was a demigod. There was one woman in particular, an immortal who'd been alive for 300 years. Thing is, her body kept aging. I remember thinking that she wasn't real. She didn't look human. But as I got up close, she opened her eyes. They were bright pink. I screamed and screamed. And Grandpa had to take me home. But those eyes have followed me every day of my life since. Mercy tucked her head under his chin and held him in her arms. He had come to eternity to fess up to the letters. But all of a sudden, he realized that he was about to tell her something else, something bigger. For 17 years, remorse had sat on his chest like a boulder. Now he was about to push it off and send it rolling down a hill with no idea of the consequences. If Mercy didn't send him packing after this, she could forgive him anything. "Can we sit down?" he asked her.
"Okay."
She let him lead the way. He took a seat on the settee and was glad that she sat next to him rather than across from him in one of the armchairs, where he couldn't touch her. He took her hand in his while he still could and said, "This isn't the first time I should have died, but didn't. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I need to start at the beginning. I grew up on my grandpa's farm in Arvonia. It was just me and Mom and Grandpa. My grandma died before I was born, and Aunt Patty was already married by the time I came along. It was nice, a good place for a kid to grow up, but that's beside the point. One of my first memories is of seeing a light float across a newly planted cornfield. I remember asking my mom what it was, but she didn't seem to understand what I was talking about. I kept seeing them, these lights, and by the time I was 6 or 7, I realized that Mom couldn't see them, and Grandpa couldn't either. He died when I was 9, a stroke, dropped dead in the corn right in front of me. When I saw one of those lights come out of his body, I finally knew what it was I was seeing. Mercy squeezed his hand.
"You can see souls?"
He nodded. "I saw my mom's leave her body too. How's that for an amazing demigod talent?" In answer, Mercy stroked his arm with her free hand. "There's more," he said, the pent-up words cramming into his mouth, eager to leave. "When I came to Tanria, I apprenticed under a man named Bill Clark, but he was more than my mentor. He taught me the ropes, but he also listened to me like I had something important to say, like I wasn't some kid who didn't know anything. He didn't want me to lose out on my education, so he got me a library card and humored me when I droned on about whatever I was reading. History, philosophy, astronomy, you name it. I was like a sponge in those days. And he took it upon himself to make sure I soaked up the right things. He had an incredibly strong moral compass. And he set an example of the kind of man I should try to be. Not that I've lived up to those standards." Mercy nudged him.
"Give yourself credit. I'm sure he'd be proud of you if he could see you now."
Leave it to Mercy to think better of him than he merited. What he was about to tell her might change that opinion. "I know there's some god out there who sired me, but Bill was my father. So when I got to Tanria and I noticed a bunch of souls floating around there, more than I'd ever seen in one place, I told him about it. And then I took down my first drudge, and one of those souls came out of it. So all those people who believe that the human soul resides in the appendix and that drudges are lost souls infecting a body, they're right."
"Can you tell where the lost souls are coming from?"
Hart shook his head. "I only know Tanria is full of them. The ones who didn't make it to the afterlife for one reason or another. I don't know why, but they're trapped there. When they find a dead body or make one, they take possession of it. It's their way of being alive in their own sad way. So you can puncture the appendix, but the soul flies free until it finds another body. If you kill a drudge outside of Tanria, it floats through the mist and gets stuck all over again.
I had no idea.
That's because I never told anyone about it except Bill.
But why?
Hart eased her brow's furrow of confusion with a gentle fingertip and traced the lines of her face, so beautiful in the dim gaslight of her parlor.
There's nothing anyone can do about it. And I should know. I tried. We both tried, Bill and I.
What do you mean?
She asked, her concern for him thickening the words. He reached for her, and she snuggled into him.
Please don't give up your nuzzle nook, he begged her in his mind.
Souls aren't the only thing I can see. There's a house in the middle of a field in the heart of Tanria, in Sector 28. No one else can see it, but I can. And those souls can too, I think. Drudges tend to congregate there.
Because they want to go in?
Because they don't want to go in. Because they don't want anyone to open that door.
Is it a house or the house?
She asked in hushed awe. I'm pretty sure it's the house. She remained motionless in his embrace. The silence stretched on until, at length, Hart gave a bitter laugh. And what's crazy is that it looks like my house. I mean, from when I was a kid, the house I grew up in on the farm. Looks exactly like it.
This is incredible.
I'm sure everyone sees their own home when they go to the house of the unknown god, but I don't think you're supposed to see it while you're still alive. Lucky me.
You think you're seeing your own door to the afterlife waiting for you in Tanria? I thought you were worried that you can't.
Mercy's voice trailed off, but Hart knew how to fill in the blank. I'm not sure what it is or why it's there, but I do know that a lot of people wouldn't have believed me, wouldn't have listened to a kid. Bill did, and he also guessed it was the house of the unknown god. In those days, we were still figuring out the best way to deal with drudges. A lot of marshals lost their lives on the job, people Bill knew, his friends. So he started to wonder what would happen if I went up to the house and opened the front door. Maybe the souls would go in. Maybe we could get rid of the drudges once and for all. Maybe we could save lives. Mercy's arm wrapped so tightly around him, he struggled to breathe, but he kept unreeling the story.
I was 19 when we decided to try it. We got about halfway between the tree line and the house when the drudges came. And I mean they came at us from every direction. I've never seen so many at once. Bill lit his flare and told me to get to the house while he held them off. So I did what he said. I took off running. Half of them chased after me. Gods, they were fast. Drudges are always so much faster than you think they're going to be. I had to stop and fight them off. When I looked back, there was Bill. He was badly outnumbered and bleeding from his head, his arm, everywhere. He saw me hesitate, and when he shouted at me to keep going, when he stopped fighting long enough to yell at me, they buried him. I don't know how else to describe it. They piled onto him, and I couldn't see him anymore. He had told me to keep going to get to the house, but I couldn't let him die like that. So I went back for him. I tried to fight off every single drudge that had piled onto him. But they tore into me, too.
Oh, Hart.
Let me say it. Let me get through it.
He gripped her to him so hard he was afraid he was hurting her, but he couldn't seem to stop.
I did it. I got them all. But more were closing in, and I didn't know what to do because Bill was still alive. He was on the ground, and fuck, he was in such bad shape, Mercy. And he told me, he begged me not to let them have him. So I.
Oh my gods.
So I made sure they wouldn't make a drudge out of him. Mercy said nothing, and he wasn't sure he would have heard her if she had. He was far away, standing in the field, watching Bill's face contort in pain as Hart buried his rapier into his mentor's appendix. His voice sounded flat and far away when he spoke again. The remaining drudges surrounded me, but I stood there and watched as Bill's soul floated to that house and opened the door and went inside.
And you? What happened to you?
Mercy slipped from his arms and gazed at him with every ounce of her kind, lovely empathy, as a tear that Hart did not want to shed trickled down his cheek. With a story out of his mouth and released into the unknown, he knew that he'd break down completely if he looked at her now. So he stared past her to the darkened doorway of her bedroom. More marshals arrived on the scene, answering our flare. They fought off the rest of the drudges and got me to the infirmary. I recovered, but I shouldn't have. That place should have been my grave. That door was meant for me, but Bill was the one who went inside. Hart wiped his damp cheeks. I should have gone back and tried to finish what we started. No, but I didn't. I couldn't. I couldn't bring myself to go back there. The house is still there, but even now I can't face it. Mercy combed her fingers through his hair, her thumbs wiping at the steady leak of his eyes. Don't you ever go back there. Don't you ever try to open that door again. If I had opened that door 17 years ago, if I had done what Bill told me to do, he might be alive today.
Or you might both be dead. You don't know if you're immortal, Hart. And you have no idea what's behind that door, and neither did Bill, for that matter.
Don't you understand? I as good as killed him.
No, you didn't.
She grasped him by the shoulders, but he flinched from her sympathy, found it irritating even, and moved away from her on the settee. She rubbed his arm, but he went rigid beneath her touch. He didn't deserve her comfort. He didn't deserve anything good, not when he'd taken everything away from Bill. Don't try to erase my guilt, all right? It's not going anywhere.
I'm not trying to erase the guilt. I'm trying to place it on the rightful shoulders.
Her words sank in like venom. Because if the guilt didn't belong on his shoulders, there could only be one other person she meant. Irritation gave way to cold enmity, gripping his heart with icy fingers. He pulled away from her touch. Don't go there, he warned her. But Mercy wasn't having it. She was burning with anger, and that anger was aimed at Bill Clark.
I don't care how much you loved the man. You were a kid. He was the adult. He was responsible for you and your well-being, but he asked you to risk your life, and for what?
I'm a marshal. He was a marshal. The whole job is a risk.
Marshal or not? A grown man who asks a 19-year-old to do something stupidly dangerous is not a person with a strong moral compass.
You didn't know him.
Maybe I didn't. But I know this. Penn is 19. Would you ask him to open that door?
He can't see it.
That's beside the point.
Hart froze, a statue of icy rage. And since he refused to reply to her question, Mercy did it for him.
The answer is no, you wouldn't. Because you do have a strong moral compass.
She was right. There was no earthly way Hart would ask Duckers to do what Bill had asked him to do all those years ago. And he hated her for understanding something he had failed to grasp. It was like the argument with Alma all over again. With one question, she had completely blown up everything he thought he knew about himself, about Bill, about the world as he understood it. He got to his feet and made for the door.
What are you doing?
Mercy demanded. Leaving. She raced past him and stood in front of the door, her arms folded.
Hart, talk to me.
Why? So you can tell me the best person I've ever known was an asshole when you didn't know him at all?
I'm not saying he was a bad person.
Right, he simply lacked a strong moral compass.
Those were your words.
Mercy put her hands to her temples and took a deep breath. When she spoke again, her voice was calm, but her anger vibrated beneath the surface.
Maybe I shouldn't have said it the way I did, but you need to understand that Bill's death was not your fault. He put himself in that situation. He put you in that situation. So no, I don't and I won't think well of him for that, whether I knew him or not. Look what it's done to you.
Her version of the truth slapped him hard. His jaw was so tight, he could barely push his acerbic response through the grim slash of his mouth.
Yep, I'm a real mess, aren't I? Would you stop twisting my words around? I'm trying to help you. I don't need your fucking help.
He stalked into the bedroom in search of his pack, but Mercy followed him and stood in the doorway.
Sure, you don't need anything or anyone. You've been doing dandy on your own.
Leonard's liquid eyes looked up from where he lounged on the bed, his jowls draped over Hart's pack, and he whined, a sound that echoed the pain and resentment welling up inside Hart. Because Hart had not been doing dandy on his own. That was how he'd wound up writing the words "I'm lonely" in a letter that found its way to the one person who could break him into a million pieces. The person who was breaking him into a million pieces right this minute as she trampled his memories of Bill.
Don't leave like this, Mercy told him as he tried to slide his pack out from underneath Leonard.
But the dog mistook the gesture for a game of tug of war. Now Hart had hold of the strap, while Leonard's jaw clamped onto the bottom of the sack. The dog growled playfully, his nubbin twirling with joy. Hart tried to yank his pack free, but Leonard's hold was firm.
Let go, he demanded. Hart, would you calm down for a minute and talk to me?
Let go!
He tugged hard, and the strap ripped away from the bag. Leonard celebrated his victory, shaking the bag in his mouth as if it were captured prey, flinging the contents all over the bedroom floor. Hart's toothbrush, his comb, his deodorant, his clean shirt and underwear, his library book. Mercy's letters. Leonard continued to growl in delight, and yet a deathly pall came over the room. Hart watched in powerless horror as Mercy stared at the packet of letters bound together with twine, her own handwriting staring back at her. To a friend. Hart's rage of 5 seconds ago was gone, all gone. He couldn't breathe right, couldn't seem to draw in or expel enough air from his lungs.
Mercy, he said, his voice thin and high.
She turned on her heel, flung open the apartment door, and flew down the stairs. Hart tore after her.
Mercy, wait!
She raced into the office and turned up the gas sconce. Then she went to one of the filing cabinets and fingered the labels on the drawers, muttering,
"Who have you brought in lately?"
Hart reached for her, but she jerked away. She yanked open a drawer and sifted through the file tabs.
Clayton, Coffendaffer, Cordova, Cushman.
She tore the file out and held it up for Hart to see, and the wrath painting her face curdled his guts. She slapped the file onto the desktop and opened it. There was Hart's handwriting on the report, the squared-off letters she must have come to know as intimately as he knew hers. She glared at him and waited for him to say something. His ribcage felt too small for the expanding anguish inside him, but he couldn't think of a single thing he could say that would repair what he had broken between them by not telling her the truth.
You knew, she fumed. You've known since the Little Wren Cafe, and you said nothing.
He stared at the paperwork, wishing from the depths of his soul that he could somehow erase the evidence of his own hand.
Look me in the eye, she commanded.
He did as he was bidden, and her tears of rage burned a hole in his chest. She was so livid that she shook from head to toe, her hair vibrating in a halo of gaslight.
You made me think that you, and then you slept with me.
I can explain.
No, you could have explained, past tense, but you didn't. Now you can't, because I'm not interested in hearing your excuses.
Everything was crashing down around him. He was losing her, all of her, Mercy and her letters.
You have to believe me, he begged her.
She cut him off with an incredulous, bitter laugh.
I'm sorry, what? I have to believe you? Why? So you can find some other way to weasel into my pants? I would never, you would never what? Lie to me?
Hart buried his face in his hands.
He couldn't bear the hatred pouring out of her and into him.
"I didn't mean to lie,"
he wailed into his palms. But she pulled his hands away from his face.
"Yes, you did. You meant it. Lies don't happen by accident. A lie is a deliberate choice."
"Mercy, please, I'm so sorry.
I don't want your apologies.
And you know what? I don't want you." She hadn't yelled the words. She had spoken them with a cool precision that cut him apart. He stopped crying. He stopped feeling. He stopped functioning. He existed. And that was it.
"Don't you step foot in this place again,"
she told him, her voice as cold as the salt sea.
"If you've got a body to deliver, you send Penn to do it. Do you understand?"
He couldn't think or speak. All he could do was nod.
"Now get out."
He couldn't remember leaving or closing the door behind him or getting into his duck. He drove for hours, and he had no idea where he was or where he was going. He had made it onto a 2-lane waterway when the agony caught up to him. He pulled off to the side and floated in the middle of the sea. His tears came like sick, heaving out of him uncontrollably. He sobbed the way a child weeps,